against a joint statement from Israel, Sudan, and the U.S. regarding working toward a normalization agreement with Tel Aviv. Political parties have rejected the decision and promised to form an opposition front against it. The news was announced after Washington removed Sudan from its terror list and offered it access to billions of dollars of desperately needed financial assistance. This, of course, after Sudan agreed to pay $335 million in compensation to the victims of al-Qaeda bombings of U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. Now stay with us for a debate of the issue.
Sudan agreed on Friday to take steps to normalize ties with Israel in a deal brokered by the United States. President Donald Trump sealed the agreement in a phone call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Sudan's Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and Transitional Council head Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. The normalization drew strong criticism from Palestinians who have already expressed opposition to similar deals by the UAE and Bahrain. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas condemned the agreement as a violation of UN Security Council and Arab League resolutions. The resistance movement Hamas slammed the deal as a political sin, while the Palestinian Islamic Jihad called the move a betrayal of the Palestinian people and their cause. Separately, Abbas Fatah movement also denounced the deal.
We totally denouncing this deal, and we are sure that the Sudanese people, intellectuals, Sudanese national parties, the people of Sudan also will reject this deal.
Sudan's agreement also sparked strong criticism at home, with several political parties warning that they would form a national front against the Israel deal. Khartoum's decision had already stirred up anti-Israel sentiments in the country, where protesters set fire to the regime's flag. Sudanese say the deal is not in favor of their country.
Against normalization, because normalization does not serve the interests of Sudan, neither now nor tomorrow.
Sudan agreed to normalize its relations with Israel after the U.S. president announced about removing the African nation from its so-called list of state sponsors of terrorism. Trump tweeted that Khartoum had agreed to pay $335 million in compensation to victims and families of the 1998 attacks on American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. Sudan is the third Arab nation to agree to recognize Israel after the UAE and Bahrain signed similar deals with the regime last month. Trump even seeks more normalization agreements with other Arab states, including Saudi Arabia. But questions arise as why those accords reached just ahead of the November presidential election in the U.S., the reason being Trump himself, who is trailing behind his Democratic rival Joe Biden in opinion polls, with his re-election bid affected by plenty of domestic and foreign issues. While Trump's image remains questionable at home, the normalization deals are seen as his last-ditch effort to boost support in order to secure a second term in office.
Joining me in this debate show will be Professor of Political Science with Birzeit University, Saad An-Nimr from Ramallah, and political activist Ali Al-Faraj, joining us from Birmingham. Good to have you on the show, gentlemen. Let's go to Ramallah first. Professor Nimr, some observers argue that Sudan has been pressurized into accepting to work towards signing this deal with Israel. And some others believe that the country has been blackmailed. How do you look at it?
As a matter of fact, as you said, it's not just pressurized. They were blackmailed quite obviously. They were blackmailed, not only with the $335 million that they had to pay to the victims, as they call between brackets, to the victims in America of al-Qaeda doing in 1988, but also to take their name off the American records of terrorism. They needed to do anything because they were looking forward for, you know, some agreement with the World Bank to have some loans, and they can't do that as far as they are in the terrorist list by the Americans. So they were blackmailed, but apparently the American conditions were not only the $335 million, which, by the way, paid by Emirates to the Saudis, to the Sudanese, to pay it to the Americans, but also the other condition was to recognize Israel and to normalize the relationship. And the Americans were pressurizing Sudan. Just 10 days before the elections started in the United States, and less than 2 weeks for Trump try to achieve something for his own election. So it's a quite clear situation of blackmailing Sudan and try to pressurize Sudan in order to take off their name from the terrorist list and to just get them the aid which they desperately needed after a while, the bad situation economically. So they were under this pressure by the Americans to normalize with Israel.
Now let me turn to Birmingham, to Ali Al-Faraj. Ali, Sudan has no parliament and elections are due in 2 years' time. Does this not question the authority of the administration to make such a decision?
Of course, there is a legislative vacuum in Sudan, as the transitional government in Sudan is run by the military, and they have no right to do such big deals. In fact, there is the pressure from the United States and from the Trump government has been made in a rush because of the American election. It has nothing to do with the Sudanese interest. There is a clear opposition from people of Sudan. We've seen hundreds of thousands of people protesting in Khartoum, only the capital, and the opposition, the political parties in Sudan are against this deal. So there is no ground for such a deal at all. In fact, the Sudan itself, as a country, big country, will not benefit much from such a deal. So there is no backup or legal part of the deal. In fact, the Sudanese themselves, they don't know what is this deal about. It's just done so that there will be normal relationship between Sudan and the Zionist regime, without the Sudanese actually getting much. 300 million is nothing in comparing it to a country like Sudan. I mean, looking into the history, the United States has put Sudan under an embargo for several decades, in which Sudan lost billions of dollars, not $300 million dollars. So, maybe the only people who would benefit in Sudan are some of the military leaders because of the history of being put under the terrorist list, in the American terrorist list. And these are the people who would benefit, but probably because they don't want to lose their popularity in Sudan by agreeing directly, and this is the reason why there is some hesitancy in the Sudanese government and their announcements.
Now, Professor Nemr, leader of the Popular Congress Party, Kamal Omar, argues that Sudan's transitional government is not elected, so it's not authorized to normalize relations with Israel. We also have former Prime Minister Sadiq al-Mahdi slamming this decision and saying that this is in contravention of the Sudanese national law. Your comment, please.
The formation of this government came after the revolution happened in Sudan in the last year, which came to an agreement that it will be between the military on the one hand and the civilians on the other hand, and after 2 years there will be an exchange and the civilian will take over and they will restore democracy and restore civil administration generally in Sudan. But till now there isn't any real thing happening, because this formation already came by an agreement, not by the elections. So far they don't have a parliament in Sudan, and the formation of the government so far, it came by only the parties which participated in the revolution the last year and a half, which they pressurized to finish the previous government and to bring in the military and the civil government together in this formation. But it is not backed by parliament, because they're supposed to have an elections, but the military again they postpone and postpone and postpone, because they are now having their term of 2 years running the country. So the country now is run by the military, generally, not by the civilians. And that's why they postponed the elections for a parliament, which would make things more real. So because of that, there is a huge rejection in Sudan, and the demonstrations today and the burning of the so-called the place where supposed to have the Israeli embassy, the building it was burned today, and the people of Sudan is expressing their rejection, their real rejection to any move towards the Israeli normalization, because they know by the end of the day, first of all, they are not going to gain anything of this game, and secondly, they are not going to let down the Arab people as well as the Palestinian people and normalize with the enemy of the Arab entity in general, just because of the American pressure and because of the American, to please the American rather. So because of that, we think that, yes, the decision is not, from the legal perspective, is not correct. And they have to go back to the people to take such an agreement into reality. So because of the objection of most of the parties and the people, it shouldn't go ahead. And if it sign it, if they sign it, there will be lots of problems in Sudan.
Now, Ali Al-Faraj, in addition to the people that Professor Nair also mentioned, major political parties in Sudan have opposed the deal with Tel Aviv, and they have promised to form an opposition front. What do you expect could happen?
This is obviously expected because people of Sudan, they are against normalizing relationship with Israel. In fact, the government in Sudan for several years now has not been going with what people of Sudan want. And for example, we can only understand the position of the military today if we understand how they are allied to the Saudi regime and to the Emirati regime, to the UAE regime, and the way they contributed to the war in Yemen, and the war in Yemen is pro-American, pro-Israeli war, actually. So this can only be understood by understanding the complexity in the region and how the Sudanian military is part of this coalition in a way. So they can't, unfortunately, they haven't, they do not following what the people of Sudan want or what the political parties in Sudan want. And this is the reason why they're delaying the election, because they know the result of the election. Unfortunately, in Sudan, usually when a military power, when the army takes over the power, they lost. They stay in power. They don't give it to a democratic system, and this has been observed with Omar al-Bashir before, and other presidents in Sudan, unfortunately, because they are acting on the American agenda in the region, in the region, which is supporting dictators and supporting people that do not actually represent the people. They don't actually represent the people of Sudan or the people of this region.
Now, Professor Nambra, some analysts believe that President Trump wishes to gain the votes of supporters of the Israeli lobby by brokering this so-called normalization deal. Do you share the same view?
Well, sure, definitely. Remember that the original people who are in support of President Trump in the American elections are the Christian conservatives, and mainly the evangelical Christian, who are totally in support of Israel and in support of Zionism. And he tried to gain him. They are the base for his voters, the white supremacists and the one who are on the top white people in America. So he wanted to gain the support of those. And these are the also wealthy American who are paying him well for his election campaign and paying also around the different states to ensure the electing Donald Trump for a second term. So definitely the Trump is trying to give them all the indications that he's the only supporter to Israel, in spite of the fact that Democrats historically used to be the main supporter to Israel, but now he's saying that me as a person, Trump, I am the only president in America who dared to move the embassy, who dared to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, mm-hmm. who recognized Golan Heights as part of Israel, who's announcing the or agreeing on the annexation of parts of the West Bank, and is in support of Israel totally, and to normalize the relationship with Israel in the region mm-hmm. With the Arab, Arab state. But let me just give you, on the other hand, a small information.
Sure.
A poll was conducted in the Arab world, showed that only 5% in the Arab world, totally, only 5% in support of normalization. Most uh-huh. of the 95% of the Arab people are against normalization. So what we saw in the social media is the electronic flies.
Okay. Now, Ali Al-Faraj, what's behind Washington's push for Arab countries to normalize relations with Israel, even with a crisis in a country like Sudan? I mean, does it serve the upcoming U.S. presidential election, or is there more to it than meets the eye?
It's clear if we have a look at how this is happening in the Middle East, the normalization with the Zionist regime, you see it is standing in a way, one country after another, so that once there is a party or something happens with one country, then they wait for a few weeks, then there is another country, and then they wait. So in a way, to keep it in the media all the time, to keep it as a news coming all the time, to serve the American election, to serve President Trump, so that this idea of fake achievement, basically, it will be there in the media all the time. And that indicates clearly that President Trump wants this to be on the news every day, every other week or so, mm-hmm. so that there would be more people in support of him in his election. Usually in the normal circumstances, people do not make deals like this. Countries who are independent, they negotiate, they talk about it for a while, and then they announce what sort of agreements and disagreements, etc., before they sign an agreement, before they agree something,
right.
And they make a deal. For example, while what we have seen, for example, with Bahrain, just as an example, is they announced the normalization before even the deal has been done,
right.
before any negotiation has been done, which all indicates that this is all done as an impulsive decision by the American government for the election in the U.S. rather than for the interest of the region.
Okay. Now, I got one last question for both of you gentlemen. What choice or choices are Palestinians left with to defend their cause and free their occupied land now that some Arab countries seemingly are slated to normalize ties with Israel? Professor Nem, go ahead.
Yeah, first of all, in a very short, let me just put it, the Palestinians should change their own mentality regarding the struggle generally. Mm-hmm. I believe personally that Israel had came to its final episodes. That's why the Trump and others are trying to normalize relations, to just give credibility to Israel and more, recognition to Israel. But in reality, no, it's coming to its final episodes, and I believe mm-hmm. that the Palestinian Authority and all Palestinian factions, first, they have to reunite under one strategy, which is to fight the whole project. There is no illusion about going back to negotiation with Israel. It should be a decision by all Palestinian factions to choose first their own allies, where to stand, beside whom in the region. And we have the front of resistance, as generally from Iran to Syria, okay. Iraq, Hezbollah, and the Palestinians, and on the other hand, to start the struggle against this Israel in any way we could have in our hands.
Okay, Ali Al-Faraj, please go ahead briefly.
Yeah, obviously, in the the position is clear from all the Palestinian leaders, that actually this is not something, an area of dispute, that there is no support for such normalization in any of the Arab or Middle East countries with the Zionist regime. All the political parties in Palestine are against such deals. because they are stabbing them in the back, basically. They support without any gain for the Palestinian people. Gaza is still you know, under an embargo. The Palestinian people are still suffering. So there isn't an independent state. Every now and then, Mr. Trump would announce something against the Palestinian people. So there is no benefit. In fact, this is all against the interest of the Palestinian people. It's against the peace in the Middle East.
Thank you very much.
Without the presence of a Palestinian state, how can there be a peace in the Middle East?
Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you very much for your comments and insight. Professor of Political Science with Persis University, Saad Nim, joined us from Ramallah. And political analyst Ali Al-Faraj joined us from Birmingham with their comments and insight.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala khayri khalqihi wa alihi at-tahirin.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Praise be to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and may His peace and blessings be upon the best of His creation, Prophet Muhammad, and his pure progeny. One may wonder why, as the causes of success, steadfastness and firm resolve is not discussed along with work and effort. It is so because there is a difference between the two. There are some people who do make efforts in the beginning, yet they break down when they're confronted with difficulties. Looking from this angle, steadfastness and endurance should be regarded as the supports of work and effort. They must be considered as the motive forces assuring that the work continue unceasingly. Every triumph is not of the same kind. Sometimes it arrives early and sometimes it takes a long time. One must not expect that everything would be done in the same manner and that everything will end in success. Works differ from one another. There are some easy jobs which must be undertaken in difficult circumstances. Moreover, the capacities and capabilities of people also are different. It is possible, but the degrees of their intelligence may not be the same. If a man is able to learn a vocation and becomes habituated to endure difficulties of the field within a year, it does not necessarily mean that another person would also require the same time to master the same line of work. It is said that George Stephenson, the mathematician who also came to be known as the father of the steam engine, was very slow in learning and in making educational progress. Yet, he manufactured the world's first railway engine. He produced the world's first passenger train in 1825. Scholars say high intelligence is of two types. One is the late-coming intellect, and another which comes soon. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care, and goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. Round the world with reporters.
In reaction to the stance of French President Emmanuel Macron in defense of the offensive caricatures of Prophet Muhammad, the Iranian daily Vatan Emruz published a cartoon of Emmanuel Macron represented as a demon, accompanied by the title The Devil of Paris. This cartoon came after a wave of angry protests and reactions swept across the Muslim world after the French president defended the Charlie Hebdo publication of the insulting Prophet Muhammad cartoon, declaring that France will not give up cartoons. The Macron remarks have triggered anti-France sentiments in the Muslim world, prompting calls for the boycott of French goods and an official apology.
I believe the republication of the offensive Prophet Muhammad cartoons is aimed at testing the unity of Muslims in the face of any sacrilegious act against their sanctities. The second point I think the French government is after is to make such insulting cartoons look normal and to promote hatred and Islamophobia in the world.
The publication of the cartoon of Prophet Muhammad outraged Muslims worldwide, but I believe the support of the French president for such offensive cartoons was much more insulting and indeed added fuel to the fire of Muslims' anger.
Daily Kayhan demanded that the French ambassador be expelled from Iran, believing that it would be the least thing to be done in response to Macron's insolence.
The publication of Prophet Muhammad cartoon shows that the freedom of expression is just a pretext in the hands of the French government and its allies to spread Islamophobia across the world.
Meanwhile, leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei in a letter has urged the French youth to question the so-called reason underpinning French President Emmanuel Macron's support for insult against the Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him, in the name of freedom of speech. After the message of the leader to the French youth, the French Instagram account of the leader's website was blocked. The move is viewed by experts as a double standard policy of the West towards the so-called freedom of expression. At the same time, Iran's president Hassan Rouhani has said any affront directed at the Prophet of Islam is in fact an insult to human values, morality and freedom. President Rouhani has said that supporting those who insult the Prophet of Islam amounts to supporting vice, desecration and extremism. Also in a statement, 240 Iranian lawmakers lashed out at the French government for the move. Moreover, Iranians from all walks of life took part in a protest rally in front of the French embassy in Tehran to protest against the French magazine Charlie Hebdo and the publication of an image of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him.
Iranians believe that fueling Islamophobia and hatred in the name of freedom of expression, which should serve understanding, empathy, and peaceful coexistence between human societies, is regrettable. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
These fighter jets are aligned in one of Iran's major airbases, dubbed Shahid Babai, located in Isfahan province. Their mission is to fly some 250 kilometers away to hit their simulated enemy targets. This is part of the last phase of a large-scale maneuver held by the Iranian Army's Air Force. During the two-day drill, Air Force personnel practiced air-to-air shooting, air-to-surface bombardment using smart bombs and rockets, and radar and thermal missiles. Military officials here say the drill was a success.
We conduct such drills to bolster our defense might. We need to be strong to deter any prospect of war on the part of our enemies. And what we learned through this maneuver is that we have it in ourselves to nip any threat in the bud.
Iran's Air Force, among other units of the country's military sector, have been under 4 decades of U.S.-led sanctions. This has led the Islamic Republic to rely on its own expertise to build up its defense arsenal. Last month, the United Nations Security Council terminated its arms embargo against Tehran, amid a strong opposition from the U.S. Iran emphasizes that with or without the armed bans, the country is capable of defending its security.
The U.S. thought wrongly that its so-called maximum pressure against Iran would bring us to our knees. We proved during the sanctions that any pressure imposed by the United States is doomed to failure. Today, the lifting of the U.N. arms bans definitely gives us an edge. But more importantly, it isolated Washington on the international stage.
Iran's army says today the Islamic Republic produces over 80% of its defense equipment domestically. This, as Tehran underlines, that its military might is based on the doctrine of defense, and that the country will never be the first to pull the trigger. The Iranian army's air force says it owes its might to decades of arms embargoes led by the U.S., which sought to undermine Iran's security. But in fact, it forced the country to stand on its own feet and indigenize its defense sector. And now that the arms bans are lifted, military officials here say this will definitely give the Islamic Republic an extra boost in its defense agenda. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
Starting on Tuesday, November 3rd, there will be a second lockdown in Austria to contain a massive second wave of COVID-19 infections across Europe. All events will be cancelled. Hotels, restaurants and bars will close, and a curfew will be in place between 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. Universities and classes for older students will switch to distance learning. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz told The Nation, "We will have to do without a lot of what makes up our lives."
If the number of new infections continues to grow so rapidly, Austria's healthcare system, although it's one of the best in the world, will soon be out of capacity.
The country's health minister says Austria is in a race against time.
The turnaround must be achieved by mid-November. Otherwise, doctors will have to choose who to treat via triage. If we act now, we can gradually begin reopening at the beginning of December.
Health authorities are worried about the repercussions of an explosion of infections in October. On Saturday, more than 5,300 new infections were reported across the country, 5 times more than just 2 weeks ago. As a tourist and sport nation, Austria is affected particularly hard by the restrictions. The government has announced that affected businesses will get 80% of their revenue from the same month last year reimbursed if they keep all their employees on the payroll. Anyone not following the new rules could face fines reaching up to 1,500 euros. The question that everyone wants an answer for is when all this will end. The definitive end of all measures will only be possible when there's an effective vaccine, experts say. Austria's Chancellor told the people he's confident they can have a normal summer again in 2021. Homa Leski, Vienna.
The United States' separating of Iran from the global financial system has hindered the Islamic Republic's ability to secure supplies of food and drugs as it struggled to rein in a resurgence of the coronavirus outbreak. The U.S. Treasury has time and again claimed that these items are exempted from the sanctions on the Islamic Republic. To delve into the issue, we talked to some MPs to see how Washington's targeting of over a dozen of banks has paralyzed import of drugs.
This is not true. Food and drugs have not been accepted from sanctions. In cases, the Islamic Republic has faced very cruel sanctions in its food and medicine sector. The United States has imposed unlawful sanctions on medical needs of those suffering from rare diseases. They are limiting Iran's access to raw materials to stir up anger among people.
One of the fields in which they are putting pressure on the Iranian nation is the pharmaceutical sector. Medicines are not used in military or nuclear sphere. The sick people need the drugs, but Washington has restricted the import of tablets and injection shots. This reveals their enmity with the Iranian people. I think our people are paying the price of standing on their own feet.
Drug and medical supply companies in Iran are now saying that the new sanctions have affected their work. Iran makes many of its needed drugs inside the country through pharmaceutical research, but treatments for cancer or rare diseases and transplants often rely on imports.
We must expand our knowledge. We must be aware that Iran will always be under sanctions by the Zionists and the U.S. Day by day, these sanctions will be expanded, so we need to have the knowledge to meet our needs by producing medicines domestically.
Iranians' access to medicine and their right to health is being threatened and may worsen if the situation does not change.
After sanctioning 18 Iranian banks as part of its maximum pressure policy, in its latest move, the U.S. government sanctioned Iran's oil minister, oil industry, and related companies. Humam Abedi, Tehran.
Afghans are marking the arrival of the birthday anniversary of the Prophet Muhammad under the name of Unity Week, at a time when Islamophobia is growing in some parts of the world and amid French President Emmanuel Macron's recent insulting comments about the Holy Prophet of Islam, people in Afghanistan are attending ceremonies like this one in Kabul as a show of respect and love for the Prophet of over 2 billion Muslims.
I'm here to show my strong support and deep love for the beloved Holy Prophet. Fortunately, we can attend different ceremonies that deepen our understanding of Islam.
We don't care about insulting words of individuals like Macron. This is especially because our leader, the Holy Prophet, has ordered us to be logically patient. Instead, we mark Unity Week to show how the followers of Islam's Holy Prophet ignore tensions and approve unity.
Based on Islamic beliefs, the arrival of Unity Week, as its title suggests, serves as a big opportunity for Muslims to once again return to the main teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, such as strengthening unity among Muslims. Some others believe that the arrival of the birthday anniversary of Islam's Holy Prophet is also an opportunity for mankind to review the life and words of the Prophet Muhammad to see the real face of Islam.
Unity Week, in fact, brings unity among nations and Islamic societies like Afghanistan. I'm proudly saying it that Afghanistan is one of the leading countries of the Muslim world when it comes to the issue of Islamic brotherhood.
I call on your audience to please study the true life and words of Islam's Holy Prophet. Yes, this is too important for anybody who is seeking truth about Islam and its honorable and holy leader, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him.
Besides calling for boosting Islamic brotherhood among Afghans, those attending ceremonies marking Unity Week say the cementing of national unity among Afghans is one of the musts associated with Unity Week. As observers say, the best way to lead the nation to a real national unity is to remove the obstacles in the way of the ongoing peace talks between the government and Taliban in the Qatari capital Doha. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
A shutdown is being observed in Indian-controlled Kashmir after New Delhi amended and repealed a series of decades-old land laws of Kashmir. The new reorganization law issued on October 26, 2020, opens up all of Jammu and Kashmir to every Indian citizen and removes every restriction that prevented large land holdings. Allows the Indian Armed Forces to take over land wherever they desire and gives sweeping powers to the government to take over any land and property for industrial use and bring in big businesses to set up their shops.
People's Democratic Party President Mehbooba Mufti, while criticizing the government's move, accused India of land grab for big investors. The October 26, 2020 order repealed 13 state laws and amends 14 laws. Experts say this is to further the agenda behind the abrogation. According to historic date check, these laws were introduced to empower the majority Muslims who were suffering immensely under the non-Muslim rulers. Not only this, but the rights to buy and sell land in Kashmir were also confined to the people of Kashmir. Experts say India's move in Kashmir since August 5, 2019 has further internationalized this conflict. In response to the shutdown call by pro-freedom camp of Kashmir, shops and businesses remained closed. Huge number of government forces were seen guarding the streets to avoid law and order problems. Almost seven decades ago, these laws were introduced to empower the Muslim majority of Kashmir. But today, when the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party is repealing and amending the same laws, the people of Kashmir are watching over helplessly. Experts say this move clearly depicts India's intentions in Kashmir. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
The U.S. economy just recorded its largest quarter of economic growth ever, 33%. Too bad it comes on the heels of a 31% plunge in the last economic quarter. The seven-month-long failure to pass a second stimulus package pushed stocks to their worst week in 7 months. The U.S. appears to have been taken by surprise by the long-expected autumn wave of coronavirus, with new lockdowns creating major anger among the businesses who weren't bankrupted by the spring lockdowns.
The small manufacturing businesses, even small service businesses, we need to assume their expenses so that when we're on the other side of the pandemic, they're still viable. There isn't a will to do that, and I think that's because the government's really controlled by the major corporations and major banks, and they don't want it.
Pro-Trump media coverage is dominated by the ever-ballooning allegations of major financial corruption by the Biden family. Joe Biden has never disputed the authenticity of the proof which alleges corruption, but he has denied the allegations of corruption. Anti-Trump media is focused on widespread fears of post-election violence.
I tend to think we're going to get through the election okay, you know. But, you know, there are enough crazy people out there, and it's been promoted. That type of hatred has been promoted, by Trump. It's been promoted by television stations.
Right-wing media says the polls show that Donald Trump might lose the general election but will handily win the Electoral College vote. Their claim is based around the so-called shy voter theory that Trump supporters aren't talking honestly to polling agencies. Centrist media says the majority of polls maintain a small but narrowing lead for the challenger Joe Biden. They say Biden will win handily when the record number of mail-in ballots are totally counted, which could take many weeks. Add all that up and throw in a few more vital issues which we don't have the space to list, and it's clear that America is heading into a historic election in a hugely chaotic state marked by fear, uncertainty, and hysteria. The vote is on Tuesday, November 3rd. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
More protests were held in the Italian capital on Saturday over the government's decision to impose tougher measures to contain the spread of the pandemic. Early in the afternoon, hundreds of far-right demonstrators staged a rally in Campo di Fiori against a new decree which has ordered the closure of gyms, cinemas and theatres, requiring cafes and restaurants to close their doors at 6 p.m. Clashes with police were recorded during the demonstration. Later on Saturday, another protest was held in Independence Square, not far from Rome's central train station, where thousands of protesters vented their anger at the latest anti-COVID-19 restrictions. This demonstration, dubbed You Close Us, You Pay, was called by a coalition of social movements and base unions.
Unfortunately, the government has done nothing to reduce the flow of travelers on local public transports, which have been turned into hotbeds of COVID-19 transmission. Furthermore, too many workers have not received any payroll subsidies from the government yet. How can they pay their bills and mortgage installments?
The government cannot close cafes and restaurants at 6 p.m. Owners can scrape by, maybe. But what about us workers? These restrictions are killing us.
From north to south, Italy's been hit by a wave of protests, some violence, following the introduction of more stringent coronavirus shutdown measures by the government. The country's interior ministry has warned that these demonstrations have been infiltrated by subversives who are trying to stir up trouble.
As the contagion curve continues to rise in Italy, Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte insists he doesn't want to enforce another lockdown, but many fear a new national quarantine is becoming inevitable.
So many people have already closed their activity after the first lockdown. Some managed to survive, but they won't survive a second lockdown.
The government is expected to present a decree including new restrictions as early as Monday. Targeted lockdowns and restrictions of movement between regions are among the new measures reportedly being discussed. Max Civili, Rome.
Violent clashes in Pakistani capital Islamabad. Police use heavy shelling to prevent thousands of angry protesters to march towards the French embassy in the capital. Protesters reached near the red zone after they forcibly removed heavy security barriers one after the other on the road leading towards the diplomatic enclave. At the heart of public anger is frequent incidents of blasphemy committed against the Prophet of Islam. Many protesters were injured in the violent clashes with the police. Over a dozen were also arrested.
This is just tip of the iceberg of a public anger against France. Protesters are saying that they are not going to settle down anything short of shutting down French embassy and expelling French ambassador from Islamabad.
French newspapers have repeatedly published blasphemous cartoons under the cover of freedom of speech. However, for Muslims in Pakistan and elsewhere, it was a politically motivated attempt to insult Islam, which, according to a Pew survey, is spreading across Europe. The official patronage to the blasphemers by the French government have added fuel to fire in Pakistan, like elsewhere in the Muslim world.
If someone speaks against the dignity and honor of Rasulullah, then we will say, my mother, my father, my children, each and every one of them, I am ready to sacrifice them on the dignity and honor of Rasulullah. Now we are not going to tolerate it anymore, until and unless the ambassador of France would have been kicked out from Pakistan, we will be here, inshallah ta'ala.
When you abuse of Prophet, when you insult him, nauzubillah, and then when you keep doing it again and again, then we'll definitely respond. Everybody in this world will respond if you keep hurting their sentiments.
In retaliation to controversial remarks of French president against Islam, protesters insulted his images. Anti-France sentiments have surged suddenly at an unprecedented level after repeated incidents of blasphemy of Islam. Similar protests were also held across Pakistan. Like elsewhere in the Muslim world, people have started boycotting French products in Pakistan. Prime Minister Imran Khan says that France under President Macron is encouraging Islamophobia, which is creating further polarization and marginalization of Muslims in the West, that he believes would inevitably lead towards radicalization in the world. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wa al-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Well, we're going to talk about business and trade according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our dear guest. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program again.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much for having me.
Welcome. Well, as I've said at the beginning of the program, let's focus today on the judicial views of Ayatollah Khamenei on business, trade, income, all right? And I hope that, like always, you reply to our questions. Well, sure. You know, people usually, you know, are comfortable with finding a job for themselves, and when they land it for themselves, they're going to go for it, right? Yeah. Is it basically permissible to do any kind of jobs to make a living? And does the end justify the means?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, your question is seems to me at least very general.
Yes.
I need to explain something about business and trade. And
mm-hmm.
of course, Islam is not opposed to any kind of business as long as it is carried out according to the laws and rules prescribed by the religion in itself. Doing business is very important. It is a very important source of income, an important source of revenue for the family and for the society in its entirety. But it is highly important and very much crucial to learn and to know the rules regarding trade and business. There are some halal businesses, there are some haram businesses, and we should know what business to undertake, what trade to do while entering the market. Market is a place where one can be very much prone to doing haram actions.
Mm-hmm.
Cheating is there, fraud is there,
mm-hmm.
and that's why Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, one day, according to a report which is very much reliable, it is said that one day Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam went on the pulpit addressing his audience.
Yes.
He said, "Al-fiqh thumma al-matjar." Okay.
What does it mean?
Al-fiqh thumma al-matjar. And he repeated this twice. Fiqh means you have to learn the fiqh first,
mm-hmm.
okay, and then you have to do business. And he stressed on it so much that he repeated thrice while on the pulpit, he speaking and addressing the audience. He said, "You must learn the fiqh, the Islamic law first,
mm-hmm.
and then you have to engage in business.
Yes.
Otherwise, you will definitely fall in a haram action. You will end up either doing riba or receiving riba or giving riba, or maybe doing something which is." Which is haram.
La ilaha illallah, wallahu akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the Library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Islam is very sensitive to, in fact, the kinds of rules of conduct
of course.
For day-to-day activities. It's not like the other religions like Christianity where people, in fact, find themselves only going to the churches on Sunday.
Sure.
And they're like Sunday practicers of religion or followers
yeah.
of religion. So Islam is like 24/7.
Of course, sure. Learning the rules actually protects an individual from committing something haram. Okay,
mm-hmm.
we don't want to commit haram.
Exactly.
But what we should do? We are supposed to learn the rules which are of daily practice, daily need, daily
yes.
application. Now, for example, if a butcher wants to sell meat,
yes.
okay, he has to learn how to, for example,
kill an animal,
how to slaughter an animal, and how to sell it, sell the meat. Or if someone wants to sell wheat, okay,
yes.
flour, or anything.
Yes.
He should know that, selling wheat, overcharging, for example, overcharging is the buyer, overcharging yes. the buyer is haram according to Islam. And also...
Or underchange people.
Yeah, of course. That is also haram because the Quran explicitly says, وَيْلُ
الْمُطَفَّفِينَ Yes, exactly.
الَّذِينَ إِذَا اكْتَالُوا عَلَى النَّاسِ يَسْتَوْفُونَ The Quran warns people who actually overcharge other people. And then I was trying to say that, okay, doing business is very important. And it's very critical for a person, especially who runs a family. Mm-hmm. He has to work. And then the Quran, the Prophet, in Islamic literature in its entirety, encourages people
yes.
to start doing something
exactly.
in order to have a source of income. Because the Quran, the Prophet, there's a prophetic tradition which says, "Al-qaddu li'ayalihi kal-mujahidi fi sabilillah." A person who works and endeavors for his family is like someone who fights in the way of Allah.
Exactly.
And then there's a well-known hadith. From the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, who said, uh, who